Julia Ward Howe's notion of Mother's Day as a peace day was celebrated on June 2nd from 1890 through the early 1900s. As you can tell from Hallmark cards today, her concept did not prevail. In 1906, Anna Jarvis proposed the Mother's Day we know today, a day to honor mothers on the second Sunday in May, which was the anniversary of Anna Jarvis's own mother's death. In 1913, the U.S. Congress voted to make Jarvis's Mother's Day a national holiday, and the concept has spread to other countries, including Canada. In recent decades, however, peace activists and Unitarian Universalists have been resurrecting Ms. Howe's original notion of Mother's Day. I would like to begin this sermon with a reading of Howe's Mother's Day Proclamation of Peace. As you listen to the words, keep in mind the context. She wrote this in 1870 in reaction to the Franco-Prussian War, a conflict she thought that could have been settled without wasting human life. Recall that in her day, women and men were proscribed separate spheres of being. Women were to be at home raising children, Howe herself had six children, and men were the only ones allowed in the public sphere. Howe thought this was a mistake. As a mother and as a woman, she felt a call to find peaceful ways of negotiating conflict in politics. She felt called to protect children, young and grown, her own and those of other mothers. And she felt that this appeal should be heard and heeded in the public sphere. I would like to invite the women in our congregation to give voice to Julia Ward Howe's words and read with me the Mother's Day Peace Proclamation. Would everyone please turn to 573 in the back of your hymnals, 573. I will read the plain text. I invite the women out there to read the italics. As we all follow the text together, let us imagine how these words were spoken and heard in 1870. Arise, then, women of this day.
Arise, all women who have hearts, whether your baptism be that of water or of tears.
Say firmly, we will not have great questions decided by irrelevant agencies.
Our husbands shall not come to us, greeting with carnage, for progressive and laws.
Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience.
We women of one country will be too tender of those of another country to allow our sons to be trained to injure theirs.
From the bosom of the devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, disarm, disarm.
The sword of murder is not the balance of justice. Blood does not wipe out dishonor, nor violence indicate possession.
As men have often forsaken the plow and anvil at the summons of war, let women now leave all that may be left of home for a great and earnest day of counsel.
Let them be first as women to bewail and commemorate the dead.
Let them then solemnly take counsel with each other as the means whereby the great human family can live in peace.
And each sharing after her own time the sacred impress, not of Caesar, but of God.
A call to peace. How do we honor this vision today? How do you honor this vision? I imagine that many of you have done your part protesting wars over the years, showing up at rallies, writing letters to politicians, and so on. I also recognize that absolute pacifism can be difficult to maintain, that there are many compelling reasons for what scholars call just war theory. The fight against Hitler is often cited as an example of a just war. I could write a whole sermon on pacifism versus just war theory. Lately, though, I don't know about you, but I feel like war has become even more complicated than that. A few days ago on CBC radio show Q, Gian Gomeshi's media panel was discussing the conflict in Syria and how it has gotten less Western attention because it is not a clear good guy, bad guy situation. At first, it seemed to be a people's movement, that's the good guys, against the dictator, that's the bad guy, but now it seems to be Al-Qaeda, bad guys, versus the dictator, bad guy. The people are just caught in the crossfire. It is hard to get informed coverage because the journalists who are trying to cover the people's humanitarian crisis are endangered by both sides. That's just one example of war in our world today. It is hard to stay on top of what is really happening, let alone figure out how to respond, what war to protest, how to accurately unpack the good guy, bad guy labels, which are often oversimplified, inaccurate, and racist, and how to advocate effectively for peace. I wonder, what do you know about the various wars happening in our world today? And what do you do to advocate for peace? That's on a global scale. Groups of national and or ideological forces fighting with other groups of national and or ideological forces. It seems to me that recently the news has also been filled with another kind of violence, killing and torture perpetuated by individual people. The three cases that got the most media attention and thus come immediately to mind all occurred in the States over the past 6 months. One man walks into an elementary school in Connecticut and kills 20 children and 6 adults. Two men set off bombs at the Boston Marathon that kill 3 and maim and injure over 100 people. And just this past week, we hear about the man in Ohio who kidnapped and held captive for a decade 3 young women and a 6-year-old girl. I wonder, when you hear these stories, what is your reaction? Each time I hear one of these stories, my stomach turns, I feel ill. At first, I'm hit with sadness, overwhelming sadness, for the victims and the families of the victims, the parents who lost kids who lost parents. And then that empty, sick feeling gets mixed up with another kind of sick feeling that has something to do with the sensationalization of the news stories. There's something twisted about the media frenzy around these violent stories. The media knows that the stories have become entertainment and sells the tragedy to us in that form. And I, struck by the awfulness, compelled by the human suffering, can't seem to turn away. I too, like the rest of the TV audience, want to know, what happened? How could this happen? I feel a bit embarrassed, even ashamed of my intrigue. I know better. How can the media play me so easily? In my rational mind, I do know better. I know that people are tortured and killed every day. According to Statistics Canada, in 2011, in our own province of British Columbia, 87 people were killed by other people. 79 people had someone attempt to murder them. 2,700 people were sexually assaulted. 2,700. And 36,716 were assaulted. Those were just the crimes that were reported. Nearly 40,000 people in 1 year, victims of violent crime. Shouldn't I be giving as much mourning and concern to all of these people as I do to the few who make the news? I wonder, too, about the ones who do make the news. Why them and not others? How does the media choose the tragedy that makes the best entertainment? It seems to me like they don't choose the incidents with systemic implications. The crime that is a result of poverty, a crumbling social safety net, racism, classism, and complicating factors like addiction and gang activity. There are plenty of instances of this kind of violence. Why do we not hear those stories? Is it because we don't care about people on the margins? Is it because the causes of this violence seem too complicated to address with an easy fix? Is it because it's easier for us to draw a circle around those people and think that kind of thing won't happen to me because I am not like them? It is a mythical construct, of course. Domestic violence and addiction-related violence happen across all cultures and classes. Still, we maintain the myth. That can't happen to me. It seems to me that the violence that sells in the media are the stories that make those among us not usually touched by violence exclaim in alarm, "That could happen to me. A crazy gunman could walk into a school and kill my child or grandchild. My friends and I could be killed while eating ice cream and watching a public sporting event. My daughter or granddaughter or niece could be abducted and tortured." When a tragedy has enough randomness to it that we can say, "That could happen to me," that is the tragedy that sells. What effect do these stories have on us, on you? I have noticed that they make many of us feel helpless, hopeless, and fearful. We look at the circumstance and think, "There isn't anything I can do to protect myself and my loved ones from that sort of thing." In choosing these stories, in hyping them up for entertainment, the media plays on our fear, keeping us glued to the screen in our hopelessness and helplessness, and two, draws attention away from the ever-present violence that is embedded in our social systems. Systems we could improve if we worked at it. So far, we've touched on war and individual acts of violence, and how both can leave us feeling confused and helpless without much motivation to figure out how to work for peace. There's another eddy of thought that started swirling in my mind related to today's theme of peace. In our hymnal, number 577, there's a quotation from Mahatma Gandhi, a part of which says this: "If we are to reach real peace in this world, and if we are to carry on real war against war, we shall have to begin with the children." This may seem like a bit of a non sequitur, but I'll ask you to bear with me. I will tie it in the end. Over the past decade or so, I have struggled with the various theories on how to raise a peaceful child. As I share my thoughts, are you laughing because you've seen her with a lightsaber? As I share my thoughts, you might consider for yourself what theories make most sense to you. I'd like to make very clear that, as with most parenting issues, I do not believe that there is a clear right or wrong. Different theories work for different kids in different families. Most parents are doing the best they can to figure it out. judging parents on these difficult choices is generally not helpful. My story is not a judgment, it's just my story, my struggle. Before I had kids, I was moved by the arguments that our culture, especially in the States where I was living, is too violent. Movies, TV, video games, people are being shot down and blown up all over the place. And these images are sold to our kids at a very young age, along with violent action figures, toy guns, and army fatigues. I have even seen, I'm not kidding, cloth diapers with pink or blue camouflage patterns. What's up with that? I knew parents, this is before I had kids, I knew parents who, in the face of this violent culture, did not let their kids play with toy guns. Parents who told their kids, "I don't like to play games in which people are killed." It seemed a reasonable plan. When our daughter was born, I thought we would likely go that route as well. Thus, when we enrolled her in a progressive preschool, I was alarmed to witness her 2 and 3-year-old classmates running around pretending to kill each other. When I asked one of the teachers about this violent play, she explained to me the school's philosophy. She was working on a master's degree in early childhood education, and she told me that she believes that including killing and dying in pretend play is a normal developmental stage that both helps kids explore the concept of death in a safe way and helps them experiment with their own sense of control and power in a safe play setting. The teacher also noted that the weapons were created. The school had no plastic guns or toy swords. The kids could make their own using sticks or cardboard or Play-Doh and a healthy dose of imagination. The school made very clear the distinction between play and real life. It is okay to play fight, they said. It is not okay to actually hurt other kids. One mom friend of mine pointed out that when her son learned to play sword fight, it was a good exercise for him in learning how to not hurt someone else, how to control his own actions, how to be sensitive to others' reactions, and how to communicate to keep the play safe. With time, I eased into this new theory. I relaxed my reaction against play fighting. We even purchased, as gifts for our daughter on Christmas and then her birthday, both a toy bow and arrow with suction cups and a lightsaber. The aforementioned lightsaber. Though we did draw the line at toy guns. She can make one herself, and she has, out of construction paper. But as I explained to her, I don't want to get anything that looks like a real gun. There are too many cases of kids confusing real guns for toy guns and accidentally shooting someone. And though we allow play fighting, we teach at every opportunity how to avoid actually hurting others in real life, both physically and emotionally. It is important to us that kids learn to treat others with respect and compassion. We are pleased that the schools here spend a lot of time on this as well, teaching kids how to avoid bullying and how to work out conflicts with words. I was fairly comfortable with my positions, but recently we were visited by some friends of ours, a mom and a dad with 2 young girls. They don't let their kids watch TV or play fight, or play Angry Birds, or Star Wars. It was kind of nice, the wholesome way in which their kids were growing up. They read a lot of books, and they're into gymnastics and hiking in nature. I started to wonder if I had been too weak, taking the lazy road, allowing the outside culture to infiltrate into our family with stormtroopers and exploding Angry Bird torpedoes. I reviewed my positions, and what it came down to was this line of thinking. I asked myself, what am I afraid is going to happen? Am I worried that if my kids play Angry Birds or Star Wars, they're going to turn into violent people who don't care if other people get hurt? I don't think that's terribly likely. I grew up watching things like Star Wars. My mom let me get squirt guns and this cool toy gun that shot out these flying discs that went really far. I did not turn into a violent person. But I am kind of unfazed by violence when I see it on TV. I can watch a shootout in a movie and hardly flinch. And I wonder, will my kids be the same way? And I wonder, is that bad? I'm acutely aware of the extent of my numbness because for about a year or so after I gave birth to our daughter, I lost that numbness. I could not watch medical shows or any TV plot in which a pregnant woman or a child was in danger, and my sensitivity to human suffering in general was heightened. Same thing has happened for Shauna after giving birth to our son. She is hypersensitive to human suffering, real or fictional. I wonder if this heightened sensitivity to violence is, in fact, the natural state of being. And if our natural sensitivity has been dulled by overexposure to violence in the media. The resulting dulled sensitivity to movie violence feels similar to the apathetic acceptance of real violence in everyday living. Not the sensationalized news stories, those seem to break through the apathetic haze and grab at the heartstrings, but the everyday ongoing violence. The 87 homicides in BC in 2011. The people dying every day in Syria. Dulled hopelessness and apathy. That sure does seem bad. What's that line from Martin Luther King Jr.? There are some things in our social system to which all of us ought to be maladjusted. Maybe my dulled sensitivity to violence in fiction and real life is bad if it curbs my impulse to do something about it. I suppose that could go either way, right? You can be so sensitive to the pain of the world that it immobilizes you. You turn away and do nothing. Or you can be so dulled by overexposure to the pain of the world that you sink into apathy and also do nothing. So perhaps sensitivity is not the issue for me or our kids. The issue is what's going to motivate my kids and me to do something. And then I wonder again about the sensational coverage of the recent events in the States. If presenting the details of the case in the Newtown shooting compels people to work for gun control in the States, maybe that is a good thing. You need enough detail that you can feel that human connection and prompt a genuine outpouring of empathy that then motivates you to action. I recently posted an article to our church Facebook group about how to help kids respond to tragedy in the news. In it, the author recommended that one way to counter helplessness in kids and in adults is to find a way to help. Maybe after Newtown, you advocate for gun control. Maybe after Boston, you contribute to the Boston Mayor's Fund for Families. Maybe after hearing about the women in Ohio, you decide to work for the women lost on the Highway of Tears here in BC. When you hear stories of violence in the news, what is your reaction? Are you hypersensitive? Are you numb? What motivates you to action? Do you take political action? Do you rededicate yourself to interpersonal ways of peace, nonviolent communication techniques, the spiritual practice of compassion? How would you like to honor Julia Ward Howe's vision of Mother's Day as a peace day? For myself, I think I might try these things. One, focus on the violence that the media does not talk about as much, the everyday domestic violence, the more complicated political conflicts that defy clear good guy, bad guy categories. Find and follow news sources I trust to dig into the complicated issues. I like Rachel Maddow, also Democracy Now!, The Guardian, CBC, Amnesty International. Two, when confronted with violent events in the news, I will try to resist the shutdown, resist the numbness, and find the human connection that unleashes my natural empathy and do something to help. I signed an electronic Mother's Day card for the mothers of the Newtown kids, which will connect me to an advocacy group for gun control. I'm still an American citizen, so I can do that, advocate. And today I'm going to make a Mother's Day contribution to Seeds of Peace, which is an organization that pairs Israeli kids and Palestinian kids in a camp setting. I'd like to close with this quotation that Rosemary Harrison posted to our church Facebook group. The words of Fred Rogers from the children's show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. He said, "When I was a boy and I would see scary things in the news, my mother would say to me, 'Look for the helpers. You will always find people who are helping.'" He continues, "To this day, and especially in times of disaster, I remember my mother's words, and I am always comforted by realizing that there are still so many helpers, so many caring people in this world. Blessed be.